speak to.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for the invitation. I've been to Toronto a few times, and every time I enjoy it more. I also lose my cell phone a lot. So I'm very pleased that there exists a Center for Mathematical Medicine. I think it's a very unique type of organization here. So the theme of the talk today is really in line with the concept of a Center for Mathematical Medicine. What I'd like to do is focus on two viral illnesses that cause serious health problems throughout the world, HIV and hepatitis C, and give an overview of how mathematical modeling has actually impacted the treatment of both of these viral illnesses. Not only the treatment, but also how it has given us insight into some of the basic biological processes. So I'm going to start with HIV, and I know there's a few experts in the audience who probably have heard most of this story, and I apologize to them, but I'd like to keep this as a fairly broad overview. So the virus are these circular particles. This is HIV. They're about 90 nanometer spherical particles. They have on their surface various proteins that allow them to bind to what are called CD4-positive T cells, or any molecule that has this CD4 protein on it. So this is the virus interacting with a T cell. That interaction leads to the successful infection of the cell, usually the death of the cell, and ultimately these cells, which are part of the immune system, as they are lost, one tends to generate immunodeficiency. AIDS is acquired immunodeficiency. And you die not of this viral infection per se, but by the fact that your immune system is not working well, and someone with AIDS will die of pneumonia or some other infectious disease. It's been a terrible problem. It still is a terrible problem. This is a successive number of people worldwide who are infected with HIV. As you can see, it's tapering off, but we're still worldwide, there's about 33 million people who are currently HIV infected. I'm sure you all know that the epicenter of the infection is in sub-Saharan Africa, where prevalence rates are getting up to close to 30%. I couldn't find a slide on Canada. You guys are doing great. So if you look here, the prevalence in Canada is somewhere between 0.1 and 0.5% of the population. The United States, it's a little closer to 0.5% to 1%, and the estimates are a little over a million people infected in the U.S. currently. Now, I don't know what the total number is, but you guys can calculate it. What impressed me about the infection in Africa, it's not, you know, these numbers, you know, you can always say the prevalence is this or that, but if you look at this slide here showing what's going on in high prevalence areas, Zimbabwe, South Africa, and Botswana, so these three curves here, and just look at life expectancy starting in 1950, and with increases in public health, increases in farming and economy, life expectancy in these countries was growing towards that of Western countries, peaking close to over 60 years old in Botswana. And then, as you know, the epicenter of the AIDS epidemic, it started in the 1980s, very early, and then spread very, very rapidly. And the impact, say, on Botswana, where the life expectancy had been about 63, when this was reported, which was 2001, had gotten down to 36 years. And similarly in some of these other countries. So you've had almost a 40% decrease in life expectancy due to this illness. So it's having an enormous impact in parts of the world. Fortunately, in Western countries, the United States, not only is the prevalence going down, but we have therapy for it that's had a huge impact. And I will mention this. So this was deaths in the United States by HIV. And then at 1994-95, should have been an arrow here, but this is really when the modeling work and sort of substantial types of efforts to understand the basic biology and quantify what was going on entered this field, and as I'll show you in the story, that actually led to this decrease in deaths that's going on. So it's really quite remarkable. Getting into sort of some of the very basic dynamic features of HIV infection, for those of you who don't know this, this graph shows sort of the two major players in the disease. The virus, which is being shown here with these red triangles, and it's being plotted on a logarithmic scale, shown on the right, and the cells that the virus infects, CD4-positive T cells, shown in blue over here. So a healthy individual has, crudely, about 1,000 of these cells per millimeter squared, per microliter of blood. And it actually does vary from about 1,600 to 600, so it's not a hard and fast number, but something like 1,000. When the viral infection occurs, virus grows exponentially. This is on a log scale, and this is a fairly accurate representation. It reaches a peak a few weeks after initial encounter, and during that initial period, there's a substantial decline in these CD4 positive cells. The virus, after it reaches a peak, begins to fall. And if I were telling you about influenza infection, which I know Catherine Beauchemin had done a few weeks ago, what one would see is the virus would reach a peak and it would fall, and it would just continue to fall, and you would clear it. It's called an acute infection. What happens with HIV is the virus falls. There's some slight recovery of the T cells as it's going on. However, the virus doesn't get eliminated. And rather, for those of us who do dynamical systems, what happens is it goes into a quasi-steady state. It reaches what virologists call a set point. And although on this graph, which the time scale changes here between weeks to years, it looks like it's increasing. If you look carefully, and this is, again, it's a cartoon, but it's reasonably accurate. At this point, at 1 year, it's something like 7 or 8 × 10³, depending on how you go across. And then if you look here before this rapid rise at the end, year 8, it's about 10⁴. So maybe between year 1 and year 8, the amount of virus has doubled on average. So if one samples a patient and looks at the amount of virus over days, weeks, or months, it essentially remains unchanged. And so virologists have said the virus reaches a set point. And for those of us who do models, what this means is it really has reached some sort of quasi-stationary state. And it's quasi-stationary state because in the dynamical systems that I'll describe, there are also the cells that it infects, T cells. And those on a more rapid time scale are changing, are actually falling to some extent. As I said, HIV itself doesn't cause problems. It's when the T cell count gets low, and in fact, clinical AIDS is defined right now is when the CD4 count reaches 200 or below. So, and that's roughly the point where one starts getting serious medical symptoms, various infections that we normally would fight off. We wouldn't even know we had them. They're called opportunistic diseases take hold, and they can lead to death. It's very interesting to see this rapid increase in virus at the end. Again, this is a cartoon. It doesn't happen in all patients. And one might very well ask, if the cells that it infects are disappearing, how does one support that amount of virus at the end? And that's not really resolved. As far as I know, there are no good models for it. I have some ideas which we can discuss later, but I won't discuss that today. Other unsolved problems are what determines the set point. This cartoon has a set point of a little less than 10⁴ viral particles per milliliter of plasma. There are people who have set points closer to 10⁵, or a few times 10⁵. There are people at 1,000, there are people at a few hundred. And so this set point can vary by 2 or 3 orders of magnitude. There's been a lot of interest in looking at the genetic components of that, called genome-wide screens. And the current state of the art with looking at genetic components can explain about 15% of this variability based on genes which typically are related to immune responses. So there is some component going on here of the immune system also interacting with the virus and providing some degree of protection. But again, it only explains a very small part of that. Where I got involved in this in an extreme way is looking at the effects of drug therapy. So this is work done in collaboration with a fairly well-known virologist in New York, David Ho. And this data comes from early trials of what are called protease inhibitors, one of the sort of miracle drugs for HIV. Ritonavir was the first such approved HIV protease inhibitor. And this was data from an early, quote, phase 1, phase 2 trial. So what went on here is at time zero, patients were put on the drug, and the amount of virus in their blood was measured. And if you look before time zero, there were measurements. And as I said, patients are in some sort of quasi-steady state. In this patient, I only show 3 data points. It was a placebo-controlled trial, so for some patients, in fact, we have a month's worth of data showing that the virus is relatively constant. Here's one bouncing around a little bit. There's assay variation. But the intriguing feature was, once they were on drug, that the amount of virus fell over the course of about 2 weeks by 1.5 to 2 logs. And it fell, obviously, exponentially. This is just a straight line fit. And what one discovered is that the half-life of virus in these patients when they put on therapy ranged between about 1 and 3 days with an average of about 2 days. Why is that important? Well, before this analysis was done, all that people knew is that if you measured virus over time scales of days, weeks, or months, it was basically the same. It wasn't changing. And there was a view that this was a very slow viral infection because one did not see any changes. It took 10 years on average to unfold, and yet if you come in with drug therapy and somehow interfere with virus replication, you can see that the body has the ability to clear virus extremely rapidly. Secondly, if there is a quasi-steady state here, one can deduce the rate of viral clearance from these half-lives, obviously, and therefore one could back-calculate how much production there would need to be to maintain the steady state. And I'll show you some of those numbers in just a second. But what's even more intriguing, that simple experiment or experiments like that can actually give us a lot more information. Not only does it tell us something about the amount of virus in the body and how rapidly it's being cleared, but in principle, if one takes a cartoon model like the one on this slide seriously, one should be able to deduce how long cells that are infected with the virus live. And that's really critical to understanding the pathology of this disease. This is a disease that somehow causes destruction of T cells. The reason it's of interest, we also know that you can go out and donate a unit of blood, 2 units of blood. You can have an accident and bleed out quite substantially. And what happens is all of your blood cells regenerate. So bone marrow puts out enormous numbers of cells. And so one of the issues was, why doesn't it just keep up with this infection? What's going on? How rapidly is this virus killing cells that we're actually having problems and you're getting long-term depletion? And no one knew that number. So let me just show you this cartoon picture. It's something we now call the basic model, the standard model of viral infection. Really a cartoon. And the idea is that you have virus particles, virologists call virions, but they're just virus particles. They interact with cells susceptible to infection, which are called target cells. And here the target cells are T cells, so it's very convenient, CD4 positive T cells. That interaction leads to the generation of infected cells. Here I will talk about only one class of such infected cells, cells that we call productively infected, which means that these cells produce virus particles. And I'll discuss in a few slides onward that there are cells that become infected and don't produce virus particles for quite a while. They're called latently infected. They are in a quiescent state. But in this cartoon, the major cells that are infected actually go on and produce virus particles. And so one has these rounds of infection and viruses being cleared. I showed you if you interfere with the infection and replication, that virus can be cleared. And the system comes to some steady state where the level of virus being produced by a population of cells has to balance their clearance. That's this quasi-steady state. Now, the drugs that are available for HIV all, in essence, block new infections in some sense. That's what the older classes of drugs called reverse transcriptase inhibitors, AZT, if anybody ever heard of that. And what those drugs do is when a virus comes into a cell, it's an RNA genome. It's supposed to get reverse transcribed or copied into DNA. So there's a class of drugs that block that copying from RNA into DNA, and the RNA genome gets degraded within that cell. So it effectively doesn't become infected. What protease inhibitors do, this new class of drugs at the time that was sort of miraculous, what it did is it caused the virus particles being generated by these infected cells to be non-infectious. So it lead to the production of cells that were not infectious, so ultimately leading to a loss of the ability to infect. So if one thinks about this cartoon in a simplistic way, and say we have a drug that prevents infection after one generation, why would virus levels decrease? Well, the cells that are infected are still producing virus. Virus is still being cleared. So to sort of a first order, nothing should happen. And yet virus decreases rapidly. So that's why modeling becomes interesting. And what it tells us without doing any analysis yet is that experiment not only can give us information as to how rapidly virus is being cleared, but it's implying that the cells that are infected and producing virus must also be being cleared very, very rapidly. And it's the fact that they're being cleared rapidly while you've interfered with their ability of being regenerated that breaks this quasi-steady state. And so in principle, by analyzing this model, we should be able to learn about how rapidly productively infected cells are being cleared. And that's a piece of information that was not available. So one can take this cartoon and translate it into equations in a number of ways. The way we've done it, and a number of other groups subsequently have done it, is to use mass action type modeling. So what we say is the way a cell becomes infected, so T here is an uninfected cell, T star is an infected one, so we say that virus interacts with target cells or T cells, and just assign a rate constant, or a probability per unit time, if we're talking stochastically, for the virus interacting with a T cell to produce a productively infected cell. These cells die, this rate delta. Also, the way virus comes out of these cells is not well known. One hypothesis is that the cells lyse and burst and give rise to N virus particles. It's called the burst size, how much virus comes out every time a cell dies. Other types of cells, other than the CD4 positive ones, may give rise to continuous production of virus over a longer time scale. And so one could also take this parameter N, the burst size times death rate, and this as a combined parameter, which we call the virus production rate. So that would be, in a mean field model, this type of model, the average number of virus particles produced per unit time. So if you thought of it as N virus particles produced over the lifespan for exponential distribution of lifetimes, which is first order process corresponds to, the average lifespan of a cell is 1 over delta. So it's N particles over 1 over delta unit of time, or N delta is the production rate. So either one in this model can't distinguish between the two. So a very simple model. If one wants to put drugs into this model, well, as I said, the reverse transcriptase inhibitors, which are these things, RT, interfere with the infection process directly. And so we define something that's called the drug efficacy, which goes between 0 and 1, 1 being a perfect drug, so it would say it would block all new infections if epsilon RT was 1. The protease inhibitors, I told you, lead to the generation of non-infectious particles. And so what we did is took the population of virus particles and separated them into two subcomponents, quote, infectious virus particles, which is really the quasi-species of virus before you start therapy. That, in fact, may be some particles are infectious, some may have mutations and non-infectious, but in this context, infectious just means the particles that were there before you started therapy. Once you start therapy, you're blocking an enzyme that's required to make the viruses mature and infectious, and so you start generating particles that are truly non-infectious, and they're actually morphologically distinct. And so the fraction of those that you're generating we call epsilon sub pi, going between 0 and 1. So a perfect drug would lead to the creation only of non-infectious particles. The reason the separation is important is the particles that were there before you started the drug were all in this infectious class, and this correctly keeps track of it. I've also not written the T-cell equation down for the uninfected cells. I'm assuming here that it's constant, and that makes the system linear and allows us to solve it. Now, I showed you the experimental data was on a time scale of a week or two. The depletion of T-cells takes on order 10 years, so we felt that on the order of a week or two, as out of 10 years, to a good approximation, one can assume the T-cells are constant for initial analysis. Can then go back, in fact, and make that a time-varying function and to see what effect it has. But that allows you to solve that system analytically. I won't go through it. It has two eigenvalues, which you can calculate. If you assume the drug is 100% effective, since we knew nothing about the drug, the two eigenvalues turn out to be C, the rate of clearance of virus, and delta, the rate of loss of infected cells. And so by fitting the solution, which is the solid line, to data, one could estimate those two parameters and gives you a rate for the clearance of free virus particles and of infected cells. And so it led to this picture of a very, very rapid dynamics to this infection. The estimates of the half-life of infected cells turned out to be a little bit less than 1.5 days. We now know with more potent drugs in doing this so that the efficacy is closer to 100%, so you're really shutting down production, at the half-life of cells while they're producing virus is about a day. This drug perturbation type experiment actually led to half-lives, if you looked carefully at those pictures, of less than about 6 hours. We now have other means of estimating it. We think free virus particles have half-lives of somewhere between 30 minutes and an hour. From these half-lives and the amount of virus present, one can calculate the amount of virus that you have to produce to maintain steady state. And that turns out to be somewhere around 10 to the 10th, and some individuals about 10 to the 12th virus particles. The implications of this toy model were profound for this field. It took the view, the worldview of physicians treating this from a slow viral infection to one that was very, very rapid. It also had a huge impact in how one conceives drug therapy and drug development. Because if you're thinking about treating a virus that's slow growing, there's not much chance for resistance to occur. Virus isn't going to be evolving very much because it's not growing very much. And in fact, at the time, new generations of drugs were being developed based on the sequences that were available, and one would target areas of various viral enzymes which hadn't changed, at least in their databases, thinking that they were highly conserved. However, if one looks at the rate of production, this 10 to the 10th to 10 to the 12th virus particles, and one includes in that the rate of error every time a virus is replicated, there's some possibility that you make a mistake copying the genome. And I'll just show you that quickly on the next slide. For the measured rate of errors, it's about a 30% chance that one base gets miscopied when HIV is copied. And if you assume that's given by a Poisson distribution, you can get the probability of 0, 1, 2, 3, et cetera, changes every single time a virus is copied. From those calculations, we could also estimate the number of cells, infected cells that were created, and these errors occur reverse transcription every time a cell is infected. And so you can calculate the expected number of new virus particles that will have one mistake, two mistakes, three mistakes. And then if you compare them to the total number that are possible, given a genome of about 10,000, means only each base can be miscopied into three others, so there's 30,000 possible one base mutations. And so every single possible change in this virus is probably occurring on order 1,000 times. You're creating 10 of the 7th viruses with one mistake, and there's only 30,000 possible mistakes you can make, so this number is 0.999 something. If you look at the doubles, it turns out you're making a little less than 1% of all possible double mutations at a single round of infection in a given individual. If you have a population of a few hundred, a few thousand, every possible pair of mutations will be in the population. And it's only when one gets to three mutations or more that the fraction of mutations that are available, that are being generated, is so small compared to the number of possible ones that drug resistance should not be a problem. And that idea led to combination therapy. And so it was really not, quote, mathematics that caused this, but the recognition of very rapid viral replication, along with these calculations that showed you needed to protect against at least three mutations, which the physicians translated into we have to use three drugs simultaneously, and that's what we call combination therapy. So mathematics really had some impact on that. I don't want to spend too much time on this because it's all very old. I want to get into some new things. But if one treats patients with combination therapy, what one sees is this very rapid decay from 1 to 2 logs that I showed you before over the first week or two of therapy, but then slows down into something that we've called a second phase, which varies now between about 1 and 4, 1 and 5 weeks, half-life, depending on the patient being studied. And there are various explanations for this second phase. One of the most prevalent ones and ones that we've promulgated is the idea that some cells, when they're infected, actually can live much longer, produce less virus, but can survive in an infected state for longer periods of time. They've been called long-lived cell populations, and there's some data to support that notion, and they produce a small fraction of the virus particles. So if you make a model of two types of target cells, of the form I showed, generating two classes of infected cells, one with a much longer lifespan. Again, if you linearize things, it introduces another eigenvalue, which corresponds to the lifespan of that, and get a second phase. It's much more complicated. So once you start getting into this, you find there's not only these long-lived populations that biologists have discovered, but one finds that virus, which you measure in blood, actually can bind to various cells in the immune system. Virus particles are complex objects. There's multiple proteins on their surface, so they bind to cells with large numbers of bonds. They have very long half-lives on these cells, and as virus production goes down, these cells can leak out and start producing more virus at slower rates, contributing to the second phase. There are also cells that are called latently infected. The virus enters them, goes into their nucleus, which is why they're red here, and those cells don't produce virus for weeks or months. That's this sort of question here. And then when those cells get triggered into immune activity, they can start producing virus. This we now think creates what's called a third phase of decay. They're much longer time scales that are associated with these latently infected cells that tend to be 6 months or longer, which is why we've not been able to eradicate it. But now let me go into some other interesting things about this for Ware Mathematics. So if one takes this basic model that I showed you, this 3-ODE model, target cells or uninfected cells, infected cells, and virus, which I just analyzed for you in the context of drug perturbation. In fact, most of the work I showed you, in fact, was only two equations because we kept the target cells constant, although you can solve the nonlinear problem numerically and also fit all of that data and show that the change in T cells is not terribly important over those timescales. Over longer timescales, it should be important. And this, in fact, is what happens during primary infection. So this is this early phase. The assumption is, in fact, patient 9, we know, was infected at time 0. Again, we have viral load data that's being collected in patients at times after early infection. And this solid black line, remarkably, is that same toy model being fit to primary infection. So now we're not starting on quasi-steady state. You're just starting with some unknown amount of virus entering and asking, does that simple toy model summarize the data? And what this figure shows us is the answer is yes. Over short periods of time, the first 80 to 100 days, it does an excellent job of summarizing the primary infection data. However, I'd like you to notice one thing, is that the assays that are being used, and the scales here are terrible, detect virus usually up to, down to about 100 copies, some down to 50 copies. So this isn't really zero. These are what are called the detection limits. And so after someone's infected, there's a period of somewhere between 1 and 3 weeks, which virologists have called an eclipse phase. The virus is just not visible. So one doesn't really know if a person's infected or not until virus appears here. And one of the things that currently interests me is what determines the length of this eclipse phase. Why is it so long? Virus is really growing exponentially at rates that we measure up here. If you start extrapolating back, this becomes some ridiculously small amount. And that, I think, is tied to other events. I think early on, this picture, this model is not right, that things are not just growing exponentially as in ODEs. Now, the other types of information that suggest things are more complicated, especially early in infection, is if one looks at the events that are generate infection. So if one looks at couples, they're called discordant, one partner who's HIV infected and the other one who's not. And for reasons I don't understand, in some of these couples, they have unprotected sex. And that continues to this day. And epidemiologists love to examine such couples. And what they have deduced is that on average, it's somewhere between 1 in 100 to 1 in 1,000 coital acts that give rise to infection of the other partner. And predominance of the data is closer to 1 in 1,000. If one looks at cases where you actually know virus is transmitted, so you can take a monkey that's susceptible to infection by a model virus called SIV, simian immunodeficiency virus, and intentionally infect them intravaginally or indirectly to mimic sex, or you can actually infect them IV and directly into the bloodstream, which is somewhat different. But I'll show you on the next slide that you can do this multiple times without ever detecting any virus. So it looks like virus, one interpretation of this is that virus can enter these body cavities, and sometimes it can be eliminated without causing any infection. Now, we think that probably occurs all the time for all sorts of infections. Somebody coughs on you and sneezes on you, you probably breathe in some viral particles, and yet you don't always get sick. In fact, most of the time you don't. So I think that what's going on in very early events, if the dose of pathogen that you encounter is low, that there are various stochastic processes that go on, and sometimes they lead to extinction, while other times they take off. So let me just show you some data. This is something that I've been collaborating with some experimentalists on low-dose infection in monkeys. And I'll just show this to you because I think this is fascinating. So these are just two separate viruses on the left and the right. It's to show that it's not particular to one. At each of these dots on the x-axis, viruses are introduced into a monkey, and the dots are 1 week apart. So these three panels are at a high dose, these are tenfold lower dose, and this is tenfold lower dose. So at the highest dose, which is introducing 6 times 10 to the 7th virus particles, obviously you can't read that, but in this monkey, the first, it's introduced to time 0. 1 week, they can't detect anything. It's below the detection limit. So they give this monkey a second dose, and now the 3rd week, the virus is at high levels. So obviously the infection took. The same thing in this monkey. Here's the 3rd monkey given exactly the same dose. The first week, you look, you see nothing. The 3rd week, you see nothing, you give another dose. The 4th week, you see nothing, you give another dose. The 5th week, you see nothing, you give another dose. So this monkey has now had 5 times as much virus put into him. And the 6th week, they only give 5 doses. So this one, there was no dose. They measured, they still couldn't see anything. The 7th week, it takes off. You lower the dose tenfold, and you get some of these remarkable periods. Here, this monkey was given 15 different injections. This is 20 weeks out. And they just decided whether or not there's something weird about this monkey, and they give an injection intravenously to show that it's not the monkey per se. You can't infect this monkey. But with interrectal challenges, he sustained successive 15 identical challenges with different doses, and you could never detect any virus in the monkey. Here's another case like this. Another monkey. This one took 15, this one the second one. So obviously there's something stochastic. These are meant to be relatively identical monkeys. So extremely interesting. Yes? Each of these are different monkeys, and these are their names. So each panel is a different monkey. And they constantly are infected until they show infection. Yes, they're different monkeys. So this is a 20-something monkey experiment. So it seemed to me that one approach, and this is not published yet, this is work that we're just fooling with, is to, say, use a master equation, discrete probability-type model. So let me say that the state of a monkey where you've introduced some virus is that they would have some integer number of virus particles, N sub V, and some integer number of infected cells. And if we want to build a stochastic model, the processes in the ODE model can be mimicked. So this process one is really infection. You lose one virus particle and you generate one new infected cell. And that would occur at some rate that's proportional to the type of mass action type of equations I told you before. A virus can be cleared, which means just the number of viruses go down by one unit if you're clearing a virus particle. You can produce new virus particles from infected cells. The number of infected cells doesn't change, and the number of virus particles can go up. And there's two versions of this model, and very interestingly, the two versions give rise to different stochastics. So this is one where we say virus is being generated continuously at some rate P, some production rate, and so you can find some time interval over which one virus particle is created. You can also do the model saying that there's a burst. And in that model, the number of virus particles would go up by this unit of a burst size n, which you can make either a constant number, or you can make that stochastic and put a Poisson distribution or some other probability distribution about it. So you would take these processes 3 and 4, you'd say that a cell dies, which is process 4, that the number of infected cells goes down by 1, and at the same time, the number of virus particles goes up by n, by capital N, or where n could be either constant or a random variable. You can take these discrete transitions, you can convert them into probability equations, which are called master equations. You can do discrete simulations, which we also do, Gillespie simulations, to study them. One of the things that we're interested in, of course, is the probability of extinction. What's the probability that you throw into a monkey a certain number of virus particles and you don't see infection? That means that the number ultimately goes to 0. How can that happen? Well, some viruses can come in, they get cleared. Or those viruses infect the cells die before they leak other infection. Or a whole set of such circumstances, those of you who follow epidemiology type of models, either within host or without, basically if R0 is less than 1, on average that these things would go down. You could actually compute the probability of extinction for these types of processes, and you call that pi sub n. So the process of a process starting in some state n with some initial number of virus particles or infected cells reaching 0, 0. You will remove all the virus and all the particles. And so these two processes, in a sense, are independent. You have to clear virus and you have to infected cells have to die. So we introduce probabilities of either a virus going extinct if you start with one, or infected cells going extinct if you start with one, which are called rho v and rho I. If they're all independent, as a first approximation, the probability of the whole process going extinct is that all NV viruses in this state N lead to extinction, and all N survive. Infected cells lead to extinction. One can also write this extinction probability following certain transitions. So if you take the probability of going from state N to state M, where M is some state that you can reach in one step of any of those four processes on the last slide, and then from the new state, you could calculate the probability of going extinct. If you sum this over those four probabilities, you get a whole set of recursion relations, and miraculously for that model, you can actually solve everything explicitly, and you can compute what pi of N is, which means you can get rho v and rho I. They turn out to be related to R0 for this type of model. And if R0 is, it should say R0 is less than 1, not less than 0, I apologize that, you find that these everything goes extinct. And if not, you can find probabilities for rho v and rho I. But well, let me just show you what's interesting is if we pick some typical numbers. So from primary infection data, where the virus is already observable, like I showed you in the that first graph. In that paper, the average R0 was estimated to be 6. There's some other work that we've done with more patients where it's of order 7 or so. So something like 5, 6, 7 seems to be a reasonable estimate in the literature for early infection R0s and HIV infection based on the rate of growth of the virus or based on fitting and getting all the parameters. For the, quote, the burst size, this is extremely interesting in this problem, and that depends on whether you follow total viral particles or infectious virus particles. Now, an infected cell probably makes 10,000 or 50,000 particles. Some estimates I've been involved with suggest that it may be as high as 50,000 particles in this SIV infection. However, only a very small minority of those are truly infectious. And if you actually think about how you could get an R0 of 5, it also suggests that a cell would have to make a fairly small number of infectious particles. And so here, this graph is under the case where you're making 10 infectious particles. We're only following infectious particles here, not total number of particles. And I'm plotting you the probability of successful infection, 1 minus the probability of going extinct, as a function of the initial number of virus particles based on those formulas that I just gave you. And what you'll notice is that infection is highly likely, even under this extremely conservative scenario of having an R0 of 5 and only producing 10 infectious particles. So even if you start with exactly one virus, even though you stuck in 6 times 10 to the 7th in some of those monkeys down to 6 times 10 to the 5th, even if we put in one particle, what this simple calculation is telling us is a 40% chance of infection. And if you look at those graphs in the monkeys, it wasn't 40% of the time that they got infected. So it's telling me something's wrong. You can also calculate, based on the stochastic model and doing the Gillespie simulations, the time it would take to reach a measurable amount of virus. So we can run the simulations long enough until you hit this magic threshold of 50 copies per ml or 100 copies per ml. And it turns out that time depends on R0. It doesn't depend on other parameters. You're varying the burst size in the simulations. It makes no difference. And again, for small values of R0, to get these long eclipse phases, as I mentioned to you, the eclipse phases are 1 to 3 weeks in humans. So they're sitting over here. It tells you have to be very close to R0 equals 1. Make sense of this. And that's not what we see again once the infection takes off. So the current state of our modeling is, if the eclipse phase is typically long, which is what we believe it is, there's some thing to be explained. How do we get that? And what we think must be going on, and we have two ways of doing this, is one that R0 changes dynamically. So in this early stage, R0 really is very close to 1, and that what happens is that infection, early infection, stimulates the immune system. That activates T cells, makes them grow, and makes them better targets, and the number of target cells goes up, causing an increase in R0. The other class of models that we're pursuing, and I don't want to present, are ones where you have multiple spatial compartments. The experiments that I showed you with these long stochastic events are when virus is put into mucosal tissues, intrarectally or intravaginal infection, not when it goes in IV. And so the idea is that, again, you might have a small tissue compartment where the virus comes into, and when it's confined to there, you have very limited numbers of cells susceptible to infection. The infections can burn out. The second compartment, quote, the blood or the rest of the body, which once it escapes into, it starts growing exponentially and gives rise to these large R0s. Either of these types of models can give rise to scenarios that look similar to what we're seeing. But what's important in terms of medical implications is if we can untie what the real events are. So, for example, if it's a mucosal barrier, that's the important one, and that it's being confined in tissues, then it's telling us that a goal, for example, of stimulating mucosal immunity becomes very, very important. If it's this other issue of immune stimulation, of the virus itself causing large-scale immune stimulation and generating more target cells and cells susceptible to infection, it says we might actually want to come in and do immunosuppression as soon as you identify somebody or if they think they've been infected, sort of very counterintuitive type of strategy. So I think we're very interested in pursuing this. It's something that's going on in my lab right now. I'd like to just turn in give you another application of how this work on understanding viruses can be translated into sort of practical medical information. So in the United States, and I presume in Canada right now, hepatitis C infection is much more prevalent than HIV infection. In most of Western Europe, the U.S., and I presume in Canada, somewhere between 1.5% and 2% of the population tends to be infected with hepatitis C virus. Hepatitis C is a positive strand RNA virus. Its genome is very similar to HIV. It's about 10,000 bases long. What's interesting about this virus is it, over long time scales, it leads to cirrhosis, liver cirrhosis, which means scarring, and liver cancer. And it can last over 30 years. So HIV has a time scale 10 to 15 years. Here's another chronic viral illness that can go on for 30 years or more before you get liver failure. There's no vaccine available, just as in the case of HIV. There is some treatment, and the treatment involves interferon, which is a natural product. It's a cytokine that we actually make in response to viral illnesses. Apparently, our bodies don't make enough for hepatitis C, and giving it exogenously can lead to cures of about 50% of people, but that also means 50% of people fail to respond to current therapies. So there's a large unmet need, medical need, to understand what's going on and why there's only a limited number of people we can currently treat. For those of you who don't know what cirrhosis is, which is the case of I had in when I kept reading this, I found this great slide. Here's a healthy looking liver, like the thing you might buy in a butcher shop. Here's a cirrhotic liver. What's going on here is that the cells, after they become infected, the virus doesn't kill them, but there's an immune response, an inflammatory response. The body detects that there are cells in the liver that are infected. It comes in and it attacks them, causes inflammation. The body responds by a wound healing type of response, and it leads to fibrosis, leads to scar tissue being generated in the liver. The scar tissue is all of this white stuff, just as you have in your epithelium. And slowly, the healthy liver is being replaced by scar tissue, which slowly strangles part of the blood supply and causes a major loss of functioning liver. That's called cirrhosis. And if enough of that occurs, you have liver failure, and goes on. So as I said, the treatment for this is currently is interferon, another small molecule, and then there are a number of new molecules following the HIV field of trying to directly inhibit protease and polymerase of it, and we're working on that, and I won't show you very much about that. Just as in HIV, this chronic illness leads to, quote, set points or steady states. These are just untreated patients being followed for up over 5 years. And what it's just showing is in individual patients, the viral levels tend to stabilize with some small fluctuations. But again, on timescales of days, weeks, and months, and to some extent even years, you're in some quasi-steady state. If you come in with interferon therapy, and I know this is, we're not technical in here, these are groups of patients treated with three different doses of interferon. What's remarkable is that you get dynamics that look like HIV. You see a rapid first phase followed by a slow second phase. So what? Well, if you look carefully, in HIV, the early experiments I showed you with David Ho with protease inhibitors that define the first phase were going on over periods of 14 days. It took 14 days for the virus to decline and then start coming down where we did these linear fits. Here, in one day, one gets declines of 1.5 to 2 logs for these agents. And this is groups of 8 patients. If you look at individuals, some of them will go down over 2 logs. With some of the more potent agents in clinical trials now, the protease and polymerase inhibitors, over the first 2 days of therapy, you see this continuing, and we have patients that go between 3 and 5 logs down. Enormous declines in virus over the first 2 days of therapy, then followed by something slow. So what's going on? Why is it these declines 10 to 100 times faster than in HIV when we have drugs that aren't very potent? So if you go back to this crazy model of infection, it's still a cartoon. It should work well for hepatitis. Here the production is continuous as far as we know from infected cells. Cells aren't being killed by the virus. So the same sort of picture. And you can ask, what could a drug do to give rise to this very rapid decline? And again, when I entered the field, the view was that interferon was named interferon because it interferes with infection, as the HIV drugs did. But for the same argument as I gave you for HIV, if you block infection with a drug like interferon, to first approximation, you shouldn't see anything. You definitely shouldn't see virus falling many, many logs in the first day. And so what must be going on, unlike the HIV drugs, that interferon must actually block the ability of cells that are already infected from producing virus. So you're shutting off this export of virus or production of virus from infected cells into the blood. That means that all that's left is the natural ability of the body to clear virus. And our experience with HIV now has told us that virus can be cleared with a half-life of a half hour to an hour. And so if you think about how much virus you can clear over a day, if it's half-lives are like that, you can get these many, many logs. So it seemed like a reasonable hypothesis. One can actually make some predictions. We can go back to our simplest equation for how the viral load changes with a function of time. In the absence of drug, it's being produced at some constant rate P per infected cell I and being cleared. And what we're hypothesizing is that interferon blocks the ability of cells that are already infected from producing virus. So it's going to lower P by some amount, 1 minus epsilon, where epsilon goes from 0 to 1. Over the course of this very rapid decay, over the first 1 to 2 days, it seemed to me it'd be very reasonable to assume that the number of infected cells is constant. Again, the liver turns over very, very slowly. In a healthy person, liver cells are thought to divide maybe once a year. They live very long. They don't die and are replaced. Under infection, it's clearly going to be enhanced. But again, over 1 to 2 days, it seemed pretty reasonable to assume that they're in steady state. So if you assume that the rate of production of virus is equal to their baseline level of clearance, if they're in steady state, this equation becomes a very trivial first-order linear equation. You can solve it, and it makes a prediction as how the virus at time T in therapy changes given the initial virus at time zero, the effectiveness of your drug in blocking production, and the body's ability to clear virus. So it makes a very strong prediction. If that equation turns out to be right, you can fit it and estimate both how fast you can clear virus, this virus hepatitis C, but more importantly, you should be able to tell how effective your drug is. What that implies, if this is correct, that you should be able to estimate the effectiveness of a new agent for treating hepatitis C just during the first few days of therapy. I wouldn't be telling you this if it didn't work. So this is 2 patients, and we've done this for over 100 patients now, who are treated with interferon-based therapy. They're treated at time zero. It turns out that there is an initial delay where there's no virus, no effect at all of drug therapy, for usually between 8 and 12, 14 hours, and then it starts decaying. If one looks into the way interferon works, it is a natural molecule, natural signaling molecule. It binds to receptors on cell surfaces, doesn't enter cells, doesn't directly interact with the virus at all, has no effect on virus particles. But what it does is it binds to receptors, causes them to signal, and leads to upregulation and downregulation of various genes within the host cell, and those genes make proteins that ultimately influence replication of the virus. So a very complicated cascade of events, and what this is telling us, it takes 8 to 12 hours for those events to unfold. So the models we use, we just put an initial delay in, say the drug, even though you give it at time zero, has no effects until some time tau later, and then this is the solution that I showed you, and this is the solution that I showed you. So in fact, we can estimate this parameter epsilon, which is the drug effectiveness. For this experiment, it varied between 80 and 95-96%, so it says at high doses, you can block about 95% of the virus production from an infected cell, not all of it in general. And it gave a very consistent value for the viral half-life of about 2.7 hours. Again, like in HIV, get production rates. From production rates and estimated fidelity of replication, one could get how rapidly this virus is mutating. It's actually mutating more rapidly than HIV. It's producing more virus. It's more error-prone. And in fact, if you look at the evolutionary tree for hepatitis C, there's more diversity in hepatitis C than there is worldwide in HIV. So it's an extraordinarily variable virus, which is one of the reasons that we have no vaccine for it. One can go further, of course, with this same standard model of infection now. I just showed you an analysis just using the virus equation. So what is the next thing you do? Well, we say on longer timescales, obviously the number of infected cells will change. So you can then do an analysis where you include the number of infected cells as a variable, keeping the targets constant. And then you can go on to a third timescale where we're saying the number of uninfected cells can also change. And so let me just show you what happens with that. And I see Siv is writing equations down, but I will give them to you later just to go on. this is actually the same type of solution as you get to the HIV case. I just didn't show you before. But if you assume T is constant and that you're in steady state before therapy, as I said, you get an eigenvalue problem, which you can write down. And when you solve this problem and fit, again, you get these beautiful fits to the data over longer time scales. So you're going out to 2 weeks, which lets you estimate the death rate of infected cells, just as in the case of HIV. What's interesting here, unlike HIV, we found that the death rate of infected cells or the half-life of infected cells was extremely variable. And they said, what's going on? Why are patients so different? And then we realized that this infection, it's not the virus killing cells. So it's not that, you know, in HIV, the virus kills cells, all cells live about a day, I mean, a day and a half, a little less than a day. I mean, it's a very similar virus. Here, it's the immune system. And if one actually looks at the immune activity in patients and tries to assay it, you find people make very variable immune responses to this infection, as in other ones. And one can actually correlate this estimated decay constant with a level of inflammation in patients under biopsy. So we think what this is reflecting is just the variability in different people to make immune responses to infected cells. Very, very gratifying. Very quickly, since we're running out of time, we like looking at patterns of dynamics. So I just showed you dynamics up to 14 days. We had a rapid first phase followed by a second phase. Some collaborators and competitors have gone out further to do such measurements. And in a subset of patients, not everyone, they find a triphasic decay. So rapid first phase, somewhat of a flat second phase, and then followed by, a rapid decline, so they call the third phase. This group, which is a German group, suggested that what's going on is the second phase, which is this longer time scale, just doesn't have to do with death of infected cells. The first phase here was just blocking production. This was a loss of the cells that were partially inhibited. And then they said at some time, some immune event occurs. And the immune response was magnified by some amount, capital M, leading to more rapid decay of infected cells. And that's plausible. Although this is a chronic illness, people have been infected for 10 years. Why 21 days into therapy their immune system wakes up is puzzling to me. So we've asked, can we explain this data with a different hypothesis? I don't know if this one's wrong. I suspect it is. And what's being left out of the early models that I showed you is proliferation of cells. In HIV, we've never worried about especially the proliferation of infected cells because they live about cell cycle time. They live only about a day or so. So the fact that they can replicate is not very significant. But in hepatitis, this is a non-lethal infection. It's not the virus that kills cells. And the half-life, as I showed you, can be very variable. So one very well may have infected cells and uninfected cells proliferating. As some cells in the liver are killed, your body wants to maintain homeostasis, so it allows replication to occur. And you all know the liver is the one organ in your body that can regenerate. You can take off one lobe of your liver, and you'll have massive proliferation, and the liver just grows back. You can actually do liver transplants by donating part of your liver to someone. So if we incorporate proliferation into such a model, so it's basically the same model as before, except now what we do is we put the logistic type of proliferation in. This should have a different replication rate in principle for infected cells and uninfected cells. You can also be a little fancy and say some of the drugs block infection, some of them block production. Not very important. What's interesting, and this is also true for the HIV models, once you allow the target cells to vary by proliferation, by linear source or something, you can define what's called a critical drug efficacy. You find that there's a transcritical bifurcation in the problem, and that if the drug efficacy is greater than a certain amount, that the only stable steady state becomes the origin. And if the drug efficacy is below that, then you can have, even under the case of therapy, continued infection. And so you can take a patient that's in one steady state before therapy, put on therapy, which just lowers one of the parameters, but doesn't push it across the bifurcation threshold, so you just go to a new steady state. And that can give rise to these, quote, flat phases that you saw before. You can also, though, if you analyze this, unlike the simple eigenvalue problem without proliferation, which would suggest that the only way the second phase would be flat is if there was no loss of infected cells, you just take cells that are, say, producing some amount of virus, coming with drug therapy that reduces that 90%, those cells live forever, would give you this picture. Here what's going on, and we think is much more reasonable, is those infected cells are being killed by the immune system, but proliferation just compensates for them so that they're able to keep up. However, to get the triphasic decline, if you allow uninfected cells to proliferate a little faster than infected ones, you say there's some cost of being infected. You're making virus particles, some of your production machinery is going into viral production. So if you set the proliferation rate of infected cells less than uninfected cells, then what happens? Well, uninfected cells are going to proliferate more than infected ones, and so their numbers are going to continually increase in some ways. Therefore, over some short period of time, infected cells may be able to keep up with their death by infection. But as the uninfected cells start coming back and taking over, that's going to suppress the replication of the infected ones because of the density-dependent process. This is my last slide, but let me. And at some point, you can no longer keep up by proliferation. They start declining. Viral levels go down. There's less reinfection, less proliferation, and off they go. And so anyway, this is this, quote, model with logistic proliferation, just showing you that it gets the data. And then the last slide is just to say that in all of the new agents that are going on, very much like in HIV, drug resistance is a problem. And it's an extremely complicated set of data that's being generated now, where you take a patient, you see no detectable drug resistance. Within a few days of treatment now with potent protease and polymerase inhibitors, you can pick up various key mutations, single mutations, doubles, triples, quadruples. One of my postdocs, Lieben Rong, who's fairly competent applied mathematician now, has some analysis of models of quasi-species of this level of complexity. We're fitting the data and trying to get some real understanding of new levels of therapy. So, it's again just an advertisement, a thing that's ongoing, and I know my hour is up. So what I just tried to show you is in the context of two infections, that mathematics can have a large impact in medicine. The work in hepatitis actually has had an enormous impact. I told you from this early analysis that in principle you can generate and estimate the effectiveness of therapy within the first 2 days. That has generated the first clinical trial in this field of 2 days. So before mathematics entered, patients were treated for 1 year. That was the standard therapy for interferon-based therapy that was designed over a decade ago. And all clinical trials subsequently said you treat for a year and you either cure or don't cure a patient. This has led to this advance that you could actually estimate what's going on very quickly if you just measure dynamics. For the new classes of agents, these protease inhibitors, polymerase inhibitors, none of which are approved yet, FDA will only allow 3 days of clinical trials right now. So we went to the state where somebody was brave enough to try one of these agents in 2 days. It's become the norm right now. There's a whole set of other dynamic criteria now for understanding whether or not you should stop therapy or not, based basically on extrapolation and dynamics, so that one can tell whether or not a patient is going to be in this 50% that's going to be cured by interferon-based therapy or not over a year's period, basically by following the second phase. You can say, if I'm on this trajectory, where will I be in a year? And remarkably, there's been a clinical study now of over 1,000 patients, and you get something like 99.3% accuracy by extrapolating over the first month or so of therapy. And they're now stopping rules of what patients should stop based on looking at their therapy very early on from these dynamic issues. But anyway, I've given you two examples with HIV and HCV. And within what I find very gratifying is within the infectious disease community, this type of work now is being accepted and valued. So when we first started, it was, why are you writing an equation in a paper that you're sending to a medical journal? No one can read that. I mean, and now the view has totally changed. In the last 10 years, we've gone from people being afraid of this to people valuing it, people in the medical community doing experiments to collect quantitative data to lead to this type of modeling and interpretation. And I think there are enormous opportunities in this area. My group and people I've trained, some of whom are here, you know, have focused on a few key infectious disease agents: HIV, hepatitis C, hepatitis B, cancer, influenza. But if one looks at the world of infectious agents, we've barely scratched the surface of important health problems. And in particular, there's very little work done on bacterial agents. There's a few models, but nothing nearly as this. Also, the same philosophy, the same type of modeling is starting to be done in cancer. It's clear that there are dynamic processes. A very unmet area has to do with metabolic diseases, diabetes, lipid disorders. There's now an enormous amount of work, as you probably know, in other areas of looking at these biochemical networks and people within cell, but there's been very little approach yet to those to disease situations. They're very complicated processes going on in immunology, where one can worry about various cytokine signaling molecules giving, again, rise to very complex dynamical interactions, where this type of modeling, we believe, will have an enormous impact in medicine. So I think we're just at the very beginning of seeing where mathematics can help in a very practical way, not just that we can write down complicated mathematical models and throw them on a computer and write a paper with a graph on it and say there's this bifurcation or there's this oscillation nobody cares about. But if you think about it and identify the right problem where people in the medical community are struggling, I think we can find examples in all of these areas where you can say something useful and that can be translated into practical knowledge. So anyway, I'd like to thank you. I'd like to acknowledge that the work on stochastic models is being done by a colleague at Los Alamos, John Pearson, a visitor to the Center for Nonlinear Studies from Boston University, Paul Kripitsky, who's been very, very important, and the work on HCV that I told you has been done by a number of people at Los Alamos, next postdocs. So thank you. No, I went over time, but I apologize for that. Sure. I would say at least the research community. So if one goes to a clinical meeting where research academicians come, who study hepatitis C and therapy, they now all talk first and second phase. And they do trials, and they will report what the first phase declines are, the second phase declines are. They think about that in drug development and drug discovery, how those will influence it. They don't write equations. They don't talk about that. But they definitely are very cognizant of this type of way of thinking about things dynamically, measuring slopes. They have various clinical criteria now of whether or not the virus falls by a certain number of logs, by a certain time, to that's how they translate slope into.
But then think of the physical community that, sorry, that's gone back to the
I don't have as much knowledge. I mean, I don't know if you go to your family physician who treats your family gastroenterologist, if he would know that. But it's clearly in the medical journals, and that's how clinical trial work is now being looked at very, very definitely.
Yeah, I have a small question about the monkey.
Sure.
You try to explain in terms of probability why
well, that's how we're looking at them, right? So at least we'd like to have a null model to say what you expect just based on chance.
Right. So I would have thought probably they had to do with the same monkey being infected sometimes and not infected.
Right. So
you kind of want to ignore then the variability. By using probability.
Yes. That's where we are right now. So we're making a baseline assumption that all monkeys are equivalent. Now, clearly that's wrong.
Exactly.
Yeah, we know that's wrong. But that's also one of the reasons, I showed you one of these monkeys that after 15 injections, it hadn't become infected. And so, clearly the question was, is there something special about the monkey? So that was, in fact, these cases here. So here's one example with CP37. After 15 injections, he hadn't been infected. So it could be that this monkey had some special genetics that made him not susceptible. We know in people that there are some things. So this last graph here, instead of giving this injection, which you can't see indirectly, they just put it directly into his bloodstream. And what it showed is he can become infected. And this is the same thing here. This other monkey, CR54, after not becoming infected after 15 injections, they put it into his bloodstream and bang, he became infected. So, our collaborators are very cognizant there can be special monkeys that do something. Yes. Okay. But unfortunately, we don't have enough data to do much else at this point. Maybe at some point we will. But you're absolutely right. There are variabilities. There's variability among people, and that's, as I said, at least so far, we can explain about 15% of variability among people based on genetics on average, but at least at the set point.
I had a related question. I was thinking about, particularly in the immune-resistant monkeys,
mm-hmm.
for instance.
Right.
If one looks at this monkey, before one injected
So the characteristics people look at are certain genetic features. There are sets of genes that are involved in regulating the immune system. Some of those are called MHC genes, major histocompatibility complex genes. And so that is looked at, and it is known that there are certain susceptibility genes that make monkeys either more susceptible or less susceptible to this infection that have to do with regulation. In this experiment, I think that was controlled for, but again, not to the extent that they could. The question you should ask me that I find very interesting, is there anything special about the virus? So let me diverge since you didn't ask that. So one of the things that's fascinating, I didn't have time to tell you, the other thing that was done is that these points that are green, which is where the first virus took off, the virus is actually isolated, and people ask, what's the virus? So it could be that you put in millions of copies of virus, and there's some special single virus particle in there, or a few virus particles, that are infectious and can make it through these mucosal barriers. And what's amazing, we've done this now, this type of experiment, people where you don't intentionally infect them, but you get the virus as early as you can, and you see these curves, and our collaborators have sequenced it. We have a paper last year in PNAS. First author is a guy named Keel, who's also the first author on this paper, which is just going to come out on SIV. In people, what we discovered, if you look the earliest sample that you can find, which is probably a few weeks into infection, roughly 80 out of 100 patients showed a single virus in their bloodstream by sequence. So one virus somehow grew in that patient. Now, whether it's one virus got across the epithelial barriers, we don't know, but one virus took off. In these monkeys, these are the numbers over here, how many viruses by sequence at the earliest time point. So these monkeys also only had, at the earliest time point, you could only find one virus, two. 451135. When you go in by intravaginal, IV, you tend to find large numbers. So we think there's maybe something special about viruses that can make it across epithelial barriers. And there's a whole large effort now to look for characteristics of the virus. There's some charge distribution on its surface or something else that helps it bind to cells and get through layers. And so that's important because if we find that there is some special characteristic of a virus that gives it a high probability of successfully infecting, it would say that even though this virus is enormously diverse, just as in HCV, it's enormously diverse, maybe a vaccine doesn't have to protect against all possible viruses. What we need is a vaccine that'll protect against the viruses that have this particular property that allows them to be transmitted. So that's another question you could have asked, but it's very interesting right now in the literature.
Earlier on, you sort of casually mentioned it, but you said you wouldn't talk about it. When you showed the HIV thing and the CD4 cells going to zero.
Mm-hmm. Right, but the virus coming up. So that I find that fascinating, too. So, and this has caused a lot of grief in the... Yeah, so people say, how can CD4 cells be the carrier of the virus? This is the number per milliliter, so you have to multiply that by 3 liters of blood or something. So even when CD4 counts are down to 100 or 10 or something, there's still lots of CD4 cells body-wide. This number, the total body number is about 10 to the 11th, so you have to multiply these numbers by 10 to the 8th. So they're still huge numbers. But what's also very interesting, which is not shown here, is that the amount of virus being produced by CD4 cells seems to be controlled in some way by another T cell type. There's something called CD8 positive T cells. So CD4 cells get infected by the virus. And then there are another class of T cells that sometimes people call killer T cells or CD8 positive T cells. So there's basically two types of T cells. In experiments in monkeys, if you deplete them of the CD8 positive T cells, HIV, SIV infected monkeys, you deplete of CD8 positive T cells, the amount of virus in their blood can increase anywhere between 1 and 4 orders of magnitude after roughly a week. If you take a monkey and get rid of their CD8 cells at the time of infection, you have experiments now where the virus levels come up, do this, and don't come down at all. They just sort of stay up. And so we think that CD8 cells are somehow controlling the amount of virus being produced. One hypothesis that's in the literature and people have been looking for it is that they may be producing soluble factors that downregulate the amount of virus replication. So just like interferon is thought to interfere with virus production, there is a mysterious factor which no one has found yet. It's been named CD8 antiviral factor that CD8 cells may be making that prevents CD4 cells from producing lots of virus. That's actually been shown in cell culture. That in the presence of CD8 cells, you get very little virus production. You separate CD4 from CD8, and you get a lot of virus production. Also not shown on here is in late-stage disease, CD8 cells, even though they're not being infected, start declining in AIDS patients, that the whole integrity of the immune system is failing. The structure of lymphoid tissue, lymph nodes, spleen, all degrades, and we presume that the habitat for CD8 cells disappears. And so with this increase in CD, with virus, there's also a very precipitous decline in CD8 cells. So my hypothesis, only mine, is that you're losing CD8 cells, that they're actually playing some control on the amount of virus that's being produced per cell, and we're getting large increases in the remaining cells in terms of their production. So it would fit, but it's not been tested. It's very hard to do experiments on people who are close to death in this business. They tend not to be volunteering to go into trials and do these things.
How do you come up with these dynamic models? Is there something guided to you, or do you just...
There is a, within the field of mathematical biology, which we work in, there are sets of models that have been very successful in related areas. So these types of models with I call it mass action, or the structure, have been applied in ecological situations for populations that interact of large-scale animals. And they've been applied in epidemiology for the actual spread of the infectious state. So I don't know if you follow epidemiology, but there are things called SIR models, where you have susceptible people susceptible to infection, infectious people, and in this case are recovered. And the types of models that you write down are very similar to this. So in that field, you would say an infectious person comes in contact with a susceptible person and causes them to be infected. So here what we're saying is an infectious agent, a virus, comes in contact with a susceptible person, call it a target cell, as virologists call it, and becomes infected. We use exactly the same equations. So it was the first approach was really done by analogy to models that existed and had been analyzed in related fields that seemed like they made sense. There's some physical basis for these types of interactions, and they work. Now, that's not to say that that means they're right. And there are people who've tried to test experimentally to what extent these types of, you know, by these terms. So that you can ask, at least in cell culture systems or by doing experiments to animals where you change the number of target cells or the amount of virus, that is the rate of infection sort of following this type of term. And at least the experiments that I know of have shown that to a reasonable range of these variables, this type of model works well. At some point, conceptually, it has to fail. And the reason it has to fail is, say you have some number of cells susceptible to infection, and you just keep increasing the amount of virus surrounding them. It would say the rate of infection just keeps going up and up and up. And if you think about it, that's obviously going to fail. At some point, you know, this T cell, it's just totally surrounded by virus. And if I put more virus, you know, further away from it and make the virus levels go higher and higher, you know, it's not going to keep increasing without bound. It's going to saturate at some level. There's only some maximum rate you can infect. And so the question really becomes, are you in the range where this saturates, or are you in the early phase where, you know, increases in virus make a difference? And it turns out we're in the range where they make a difference. If one looks, it's very interesting. So, you know, if you play physicist, what's going on is CD4 cells are generated per microliter. Millimeter squared is a microliter. Virus is measured per milliliter. So there's a thousand-fold difference. So the number of T cells, if you did it per milliliter, this has to go up a thousand-fold. So there's about a million T cells per milliliter of blood, and a million virus particles is high. So to me, it says that in the average patient, at least in the blood, the ratio of T cells to virus particles, 1:1, 10:1, 1/10:1, so they're, you know, sort of similar numbers. So I wouldn't expect any sort of nonlinear effects to be coming in at these densities. So that's another way to think about a justification for just having a simple type of mass action model. If I had 10^6 more virus particles in cells, then I'd say maybe I should start worrying about the fact that things would be saturating. So anyway, that's how I've thought about it. Whether it's right, I can't tell you. These models tend to work in the sense that they fit data and they've given us insight. At some point, we may be able to find more precise models.
And you're only sort of driven by the fact that if you get nice mathematical descriptions of the problem, whereas the model describes
there are, there are some people. It's not as active an area. I mean, Catherine Beauchemin here has a sort of two-dimensional simulation. There are a number of people who have done cellular automata-like models. They've put in spatial effects when you start doing these simulations. And you can see some differences. What's difficult is trying to validate these more complex simulation models, because the types of data that we collect is this. I mean, this is, you know, from a clinical article. This is the types of things that people measure. They just take out some blood, and they measure the amount of virus and the number of T cells. Occasionally you can get a sample of a lymph node or something, but you don't have large-scale spatial information to drive this. It's another area I think that there's be interesting to do more work on, theoretically, and whether or not we can find the data to validate it is still uncertain. But you're absolutely right. And they do give slightly different answers. Yes?
I just want to follow on this one. So is it possible actually to experiment not on living animal or human? Can you actually do lab experiments?
So for HIV, you can do things in cell culture. So you can take out T cells, either from human, and that's fine, or from a monkey, and put them in a dish, and you can infect them. And you can count things, and you can do that experiment.
Can you use that to kind of
Yes and no. The problem is, you know, the circumstances are very different. The way cells grow, assuming that they grow, would be different. In the case of HIV, that was done, say, to see whether or not our estimate that cells live about a day when they're productively infected. So that's been validated in cell culture. So you can do that. There are more refined models that I didn't go into. I mean, this work's been going on for over a decade, and there's now hundreds of models. But one elaboration puts in time delays. So we know that when a virus enters, that it takes some time before it becomes productively infected. So where's my model again? So just saying that an uninfected cell, KTV, shows up as a productively infected cell instantly is wrong. So you could say, well, it takes some length of time to go from this state to one where you're actually producing virus. And that can be measured to some extent in cell culture. You could also build, and we have, age-structured models. So one could say that the amount of virus being produced, say we go to this notion of a production rate over here, and say that the amount of virus being produced, I would call this P, is a function of age, where age is the age of infection. And now write PDEs, and that can be validated in cell culture experiments. One can try and look is how long from the time a cell is infected until it starts producing virus, how does that ramp up? I mean, it obviously doesn't go from making zero virus to all of a sudden making 50,000 viruses in one instant of time or something. So if you're, you know, depending on the time scale that you're interested in, yes, there are certain cell culture experiments that would be very